Welcome to the Wampa's Lair podcast. Deep in the bowels of the frozen ice caverns of Hoth, our hosts, Carl LeClaire and Jason Hunt, have been frozen upside down to the cave ceiling with nothing to do but talk all things Star Wars. So make yourselves comfortable, but keep a wary eye out for trouble here in the Wampa's Lair.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another exciting episode of the Wampa's Lair podcast. This is episode 75, Plastic Galaxy, an interview with Brian Stillman. I am your host, Carl LeClaire. Unfortunately, Jason Hunt can't be with us tonight, but that's fine, because we are joined with the amazing Brian Stillman, the creator of Plastic Galaxy, the story of Star Wars toys. Brian, it's so good to have you.
Thanks for having me. I don't know if I'm amazing, but I appreciate the sentiment. My mom thinks I'm amazing. Said something.
That's what my mom says. The same thing. I'm so happy you could come on. I mean, I literally placed my order for your movie the day that you posted. You know, place your orders. I was like, hell yeah. And I got it a few days later. And you dealt with the PayPal or whatever it was, something with the shipping problem. It was saying your thing didn't ship, and then you immediately responded to that on Facebook saying here's what happened. Don't anybody worry.
I got to tell you, the biggest learning experience for this whole thing has been dealing with shipping out hundreds of DVDs and figuring out all these different online postage systems. And PayPal is the devil of shipping. It's sort of astonishing. So yeah, when that happened, all I wanted to do was cancel some labels, and suddenly it was sending out messages to everyone saying their orders were canceled. I don't know. I was like, oh my God, this is a nightmare. So I'm glad everyone seemed to take it in stride.
Yeah. Well, I mean, again, your response was perfect. I got that email that said that it's your order has been canceled. I'm like, what? It says contact Brian Stillman. I'm like, what? This dude's probably too busy. And then you meet within hours, it was you had that post up on Facebook saying here's what happened. Don't worry. I was like, okay. And then literally 2 days later, it was at my door.
I'm glad that my words soothed everyone, because I was freaking out, believe me.
But that was what good showmanship, though, to immediately respond to that. It was great, you know. But anyway, enough about that. I mean, this movie was awesome. I assume that you, like myself, you know, are a diehard Star Wars fan. And this movie was just perfect. I didn't know what to expect, to be honest. When I first heard about you putting together this movie, I don't even remember where I heard it. I mean, it was somewhere on Facebook. And as soon as I started following it and just seeing the pictures that you were putting up along the way, I was like, this thing is going to be freaking awesome. And I didn't know what to expect sitting down to watch it. But it's it starts off where it's just a lot of fun. And then you kind of really get into the production side of it, which I didn't know any of that stuff.
Well, you know, when we, so yeah, I'm a huge Star Wars fan. And I'm also a toy collector, and you know, I had these toys as a kid, and I got out of them for a while, but got back in. And for me, it was really okay, I want to learn as much about these toys as possible. And I assumed someone had made a movie already. And when I discovered that they hadn't, I said, well, okay, I'm a journalist and I've done documentary work before, so I guess I'll do it. But the thing I was totally aware of going into it was how do I find that balance where it celebrates the toys, but also gives people information. And I didn't want to just sort of be there saying into the camera, you know, these toys are cool, trust me. I wanted to really kind of try and capture that from the people who grew up with them and collected them and were kind of just like me. And so I'm glad, you know, it's nice to hear you kind of pick up on that, because it means I guess I did a pretty good job with it. And that came through, because that was really important. You know, I think you don't want a movie like this to just be here's how they were made. And you don't want them to just be, and this figure is Luke, and this figure is Ben, and this figure is Star. Like, you don't want it to be this kind of, you know, list of stuff. But I wasn't 100% sure going into it if it would work, you know? So it's good to hear that sort of came through. Because honestly, I was just winging it, hoping for the best.
Dude, it was awesome. I mean, and as somebody who, like, I thoroughly enjoys documentaries, period, just in general. I mean, from even a documentary standpoint, I mean, it's even if you were somebody who wasn't, like, a huge Star Wars fan, but you were just interested in, like, toy collecting or even, you know, toys in general or marketing, I mean, it's so informative, yet so fun. Like, it was the perfect combo.
You know, the thing about it is there's a story there. You know what I mean? Like, there has to be some content there for me to work with, or else, you know, you're kind of left, no matter who's making the film, it could be Martin Scorsese, you know, someone who's a gajillion times better than I am, and if there's no story there, you're kind of out of luck. And I think the cool thing about Star Wars toys is there is that kind of great narrative and history behind them. It's not this situation where it's just like, oh, these toys are cool and they're connected to Star Wars. There's this whole kind of drama there, like, you know, nobody expected them to be anything, so all these toy companies passed, and then Kenner, this kind of mid-level company that had a few sort of action figure successes, but nothing like this, they took it on, and they didn't know what they were getting into, and Lucasfilm didn't know what they were getting into. Nobody knew what they were getting into, and this thing just exploded. And the fact that there's kind of that narrative arc already in place makes this the type of movie that is a little bit easier to kind of put together and find something interesting in. So from my point of view, I really lucked out in that there was such a strong kind of history there to even work with. Because if not, I don't know what I would have done. You know, you end up just saying, again, it goes back to these toys are cool, and here's Luke, here's Ben, here's Vader. And
a glorified show and tell.
Yeah, and I didn't want it to be that. And I didn't think anyone else wanted that, because it's, you know, they know all that already. You know, if you're collecting these toys, you certainly know which figure's which. So, but it really is a story that has a lot of sort of meat to it, which for me as a filmmaker, but also as a collector, I mean, that's awesome, because I love the history of the things I collect. I don't want to just have these objects. I like learning about them and knowing about them. So it all kind of goes hand in hand.
That's awesome. That kind of leads me into my first question, which is the pretty basic one that I'm sure a lot of people have asked you, but, you know, where'd you come up with the idea to do this documentary? Like, how did this come about?
So like I said before, I grew up with Star Wars toys when I was a little kid. I'm 38 years old, so I was born in 1975, and I first saw Star Wars as a re-release in 79. And I vaguely remember it, but my dad has corroborated the story. He took me, and he remembers, so I guess it's true. And of course I saw Empire when it came out, and I saw Jedi when it came out, and I had these toys, but eventually I kind of grew out of them. And I got into G.I. Joe and He-Man and Transformers and all that stuff. And then eventually I got, you know, I became a teenager and kind of got out of that stuff. And sort of always loved Star Wars, but wasn't really into the toys for a long time. And I started collecting vintage space toys, actually, things from the 30s, 40s, and 50s, like old robots and ray guns and Buck Rogers stuff and Flash Gordon and things like that. And, you know, I'd see Star Wars toys now and again, but I'd say to myself, you know, they're kind of too recent. I love Star Wars, but I don't need another collection. And I'm really into this stuff from, like, kind of the beginning of science fiction toys. And so I kind of ignored them. I kind of forced myself to ignore them. And then one day I went into this store called Love Saves the Day, which was a store in New York City. There's also one in Pennsylvania, and it's closed in New York now. But this was maybe 5 years ago, I guess. And they had this awesome display of the first 12 figures and the action stand. And then they had all these box toys for sale and all this other stuff. And something in my brain just flipped like a switch. It was the weirdest thing. And I was suddenly hit with all this nostalgia. And I kind of tried to ignore it. But eventually, a little while later, I ended up buying an R2 figure, one of the first, you know, the first original 12 figures. And I said, well, you know, it's a robot. And I love R2. And I can kind of justify it because it's just a robot, just like all my other toys. And then I started collecting R2s and then other droids. And then, well, okay, got to get the rest. And then eventually, of course, it spiraled out of control. And I'm the type of collector who likes to know about the stuff he collects. I love doing research. I love learning about the history. And like I said before, you know, I said, you know, I read Sansweet's book From Concept to Screen to Collectible, and that made my head explode. And I said, there has to be a movie about this. It's been 30-something years at this point. Somebody had to have done this. And I couldn't find anything. So I started asking around, and there wasn't anything. So I said, okay, well, if I really want to learn about these toys, the best way is to just go out and start talking to people. And if nobody else has made a movie, I guess I will too. I figured if I'm going to go out and talk to people and see all these collections, I might as well kind of bring a camera and let everybody else in on it as well.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, people will, like, open their door to you if you say, like, I'm making a film. And suddenly you're like, oh, now I'm looking at Gus Lopez's collection. All right. Thank you, Mr. Video Camera. you know, all these people were really generous about letting me in and talking to me. And that's sort of where it came from, is really just my own sort of frustration that somebody hadn't done it already. So, and that was it. Didn't quite realize how big a project it would become, but...
How long did it take you to put it all together?
Well, it's kind of a tricky question, because it's been about... It was about 3 years between when I first started poking around and when the film finally came out. I forget exactly when I started, but it was somewhere towards the end of 2010. And, you know, during that time, you know, you spend a lot of time traveling and shooting, but then there's time in between where you're not doing anything. You know what I mean? So it was this 3-year process, but, you know, you're on the road for 14 days in Ohio interviewing collectors and Kenner people and stuff like that, but then you're home for a month, you know, until the next, like, big trip and interviews come along. So I couldn't tell you exactly how many sort of, like, days, like, were literally spent working on the film, but it was spread out over 3 years, so it was a pretty long process. Longer than I thought it would be, to be honest. Mm. Much longer.
Well, your work paid off, I'll say that. So.
Well, you know, it's funny, because some of the delays, you know, because when we first announced the movie, I did a lot of work on it, and then I decided to do a Kickstarter campaign. And in the Kickstarter campaign, I said it'll be out 2012. And at the time, it kind of looked like that'd be the case. But then I got more access to stuff, and that pushed it back. And, you know, suddenly I discovered some other Kenner guys and all this other stuff. So then I'm like, okay, it's definitely coming out whenever. I said some other date. And then at one point, I was like, okay, September 2013. Absolutely. And it sort of kept getting pushed back. And eventually it was getting pushed back, not because I was holding out for better stuff, but because I just wanted to do it right. And I didn't want to rush it for a deadline that only existed because I made it up at the time. You know, it wasn't like I had to go to air or anything like that. So the plus side of all that, though, was as I was struggling to get it done, things were falling into my lap. You know, these amazing photos of the sort of kit-bashed figures. I didn't have those. I didn't expect to get those. And, you know, I wasn't going to hold up the film to try and find them. But because it just happened to be taking, you know, a month longer than I thought or 2 months longer than I thought, those things became available. So great, I could put them in. So in a way, the delay, while frustrating, was kind of fortuitous because these things came out of the woodwork without me even looking for them, simply because it took that long for them to come out of the woodwork. So that's the big silver lining that I that I choose to cling to desperately like a drowning man.
How did you go about getting in touch with all the different collectors you met with? Or even, Steve Sansweet is in there quite a bit. And, you know, as everybody knows, I mean, Steve Sansweet is kind of the guru of Star Wars collecting. But, like, how did you go about getting, you know, I mean, you went to obviously private collectors all the way up to, you know, to Steve Sansweet. I mean, you were kind of covering it all. How did you get in touch with all these different people? And everybody was, you know, everyone's collection, like, everything I saw, I was like, damn, I want that. Like, it was awesome. But, like, how did you go about setting all that up?
You know, it started with a friend of mine. He's actually he's listed as a consulting producer in the credits, a guy named John Alvarez. John has been in the hobby for a long time. He's an editor at the Star Wars Collectors Archive, which is a site that Gus started. It was kind of the first Star Wars site, as far as I know. And John's really hardcore into this stuff, and he's big on research and everything too. So when he found out I was doing this, he was really sort of excited by the prospect because it touched a lot of things that he finds interesting. And he was nice enough to help put me in touch with Gus. And when I met Gus Lopez, he then opened up the door to other people in Seattle that he knew, people like Lisa Stevens and Vic Wirtz. You know, they have an amazing collection, and a bunch of other people. Jason Luttrell, he's in Seattle. Tom Stewart, a bunch of other people, and so that sort of opened up that side of things. Then he helped. I think he's the one who also helped put me in touch with Steve. Steve's not a hard person to track down. You know, he's very public, so I probably could have found him on my own, but having Gus as an introduction helped a lot. There's also a collector who I spoke to, but ended up, unfortunately, kind of not making it into the final version of the film, named Dustin Roberts, and he's a editor for at Rebel Scum and Force.net, and he's good friends with Steve as well, and he helped make some introductions between the two of us. And actually, when I was out at Fan Days in Dallas few years ago,
I was there.
Okay, it was the year before Celebration.
Yep.
And that's where I first met Steve face to face. So between Dustin and Gus, they kind of helped kind of corner Steve, and Steve had gotten my emails, and, you know, we talked, and he said he'd do it. And then the Kenner guys, you know, that was just luck, you know. I had found Jim Swearingen's name. He was a member of Preliminary Design. He was one of the first people to read the script when Lucasfilm brought it around to Kenner. I found him online. You know, he had been interviewed by his alumni magazine or something, and once I had his name, I just figured, well, he's got to be out there. And then I think Gus helped me with that one as well. And then Jim gave me the names of some other Kenner guys, and it kind of spirals out from there. So it's all about networking. It's all about asking people if they know anyone. And then there are people on Rebel Scum who I'd become friendly with. Alex Miller is a good example. Bobby Sharp. These are people I knew through Rebel Scum. And I reached out to them, and they were interested in doing it. John Booth wrote Collect All 21. He was very prominent on Rebel Scum. I read his book and loved it, and so I reached out to him. So it's really just, you know, kind of beating the bushes and seeing who kind of comes running out and who might be interested in talking.
Yeah. The connections you had with the people from Kenner was awesome. I mean, you had the higher up echelon people, like the managers and project, you know, managers, to the guys who like designed the toys. And it was such another great gambit of, you know, different types of people to talk to. I mean, you had people telling you kind of the higher up marketing stuff to the guy, that one guy, I can't remember his name. He was quite the character, the one who kept making all the different designs. He wanted to keep designing anything that was robotic, even if it wasn't in the film.
That was Tom Troy. He was a member of Preliminary Design with Jim Swearingen. I met him at Celebration, actually. There was a party thrown by some collectors, and a friend of mine named Josh Blake, who's a big micro collector, like the micro line, he dragged me over to this room, and he said, "Listen, you need to meet this guy." And he introduced me to Tom Troy, and we're chatting, and then Tom tells me that he created the troop transport, which was my favorite toy as a kid. That was my favorite Star Wars toy, and I think my eyes were just wide for the rest of the evening as he told me about all this stuff, and I was like, "Do you have any interest in being in my film?" And he was gracious enough to say yes. So a couple months later, I flew back out to Florida, and both him and Ed Schiffman, who was the guy who came up with the Early Bird set, they were both in Florida, entirely different parts of the state. I've never driven through so much of Florida in my life. But they agreed to be. So again, that was just luck, Well, luck that Tom Troy lives in Florida and Celebration was in Florida. And then a friend of mine, Josh, knowing that I was looking for Kenner guys and helping to hook me up. But that was, I wish I could have found more of them. It's important when telling stories like this to get as close to the original sources as possible. It's sort of a rule of journalism. First person sources are your best sources, in many cases, not all, but sometimes their memories aren't so great. And you rely on people like Steve or Gus or Ron Salvatore, who have spoken to so many Kenner guys over the years that they've figured out the real story. As opposed to an individual Kenner guy who might completely misremember something, which happened a few times. But, generally, you want to get these guys who were there and who experienced it and who can kind of speak from those sort of real life moments from their own history and that helps bring it to life. So it was really important to find those guys. Plus, it was a thrill. I mean, for me, it was like, you're the guy. This is awesome.
That must have been like, this is a kind of a broader question, but like, I mean, this must have been just freaking awesome to be able to do this.
Yeah. It was very hard. So here's the deal. I was a music journalist for a long time. And I've interviewed, like, Ozzy Osbourne. I've interviewed, my all-time favorite band is this band called Ministry. And I spent a weekend living with the band down in Texas, doing things that I can't even talk about on the air because it was just so messed up. And through all those moments, I was professional. I kept it together. I didn't nerd out. I didn't become a fanboy or anything like that. I did my job. And I got to tell you, when I met some of these Kenner guys, that was some of the hardest moments I've ever had, keeping it together and not becoming just a total drooling fanboy, because it was so cool to meet these guys. So it's like, and they're real humble about it. That's the thing. Like they understand Star Wars is cool. They're not like, completely clueless to this, but they, they're sort of amazed that anyone cares quite this much. But I was, it took all my strength to not be just sort of pathetic about the whole thing, because it was awesome. It was amazing. And then like to meet Steve Sansweet and get to see his collection, to meet Gus Lopez, get to see his collection. And then people who aren't necessarily famous for their collections, but have amazing collections. Bobby Sharp, pretty much everybody has, like in the film, has an amazing collection. And having that opportunity to see all these toys was incredible. I mean, it was so much fun. I won't lie. You know, this is a lot of work, but man, it was awesome.
That's awesome. I mean, so did you have to put like a lot of research into like what you were doing and everything, or did the research just kind of come out of meeting the people that were there? I mean, it's extremely informed. The information that you provide is really informed. It's not just like, oh, here's a guy that I found from Kenner, so he's going to talk now. And then here's a guy with a private, I mean, it's very well put together, and it's very clear that you obviously must have done some sort of research. And I'm just curious, like, how much did you have to do, and where did you go about getting all that information?
Well, here's the thing. You cannot go into a project like this cold. And, you know, I've taught undergrads before and stuff like that, and I'll tell them, when you're doing an interview, you can't just sort of show up and go fishing for information. You have to know as much as possible about what you're talking about so that you can ask intelligent questions. You can ask questions that will yield answers that are useful to you in the film. And I'm not saying you want to go in with an agenda, you know, and I have to get, you know, I'm going to ask him this question and he has to tell me X, Y, Z. It's not like that at all, but you have to ask questions that will yield answers that will help you construct some sort of story. You don't always know what the story is going to be. You know, you go in with an idea of what you think the story is going to be, but you remain really flexible because it can go in any sort of direction depending on how they answer. But you have to make sure your questions are at least informing the story of Star Wars toys, you know, whatever that may turn out to be. So, yeah, I did a ton of research going into it. I read every website I could find. I would talk to friends who had been in the hobby for much longer than I had. I read every book I could find. You know, Steve Sansweet's book was great. From concept to screen to collectible. I could not have made this movie without that book because it kind of laid the foundation. I mean, basically, it is what my film is. He just interviewed different people and told the story in a different way. But the basic facts, I mean, they are what they are. So, you know, whether he tells the story 15 years ago or whether he tells the story today, it is what it is. So that book really gave me the context I needed to figure out what I then needed to know. The other thing is, I tried to do pre-interviews with everybody that I spoke to on camera. So I would call them up and say, look, this is more or less off the record. It's really just background. I want to know, I want to sort of talk to you ahead of time so that when we sit down on camera, I'm asking questions that you even have answers to. I don't want to talk about something that's completely outside your realm of experience. But also, so that I'm not wasting anyone's time, your time, my time, anyone's time, by kind of going down paths that are maybe not as helpful or asking questions that are like kind of ridiculous because I didn't do my homework. So that helps a lot. So I would call up Jim Swearengen and talk to him for like half an hour or an hour beforehand so I could get the most out of the interview actually in front of the camera as possible. But even then, you know, things go in directions you couldn't possibly predict, you know, because it's not like it's scripted or anything like that. It's, you have a gist of what you're going to talk about, but then inevitably stuff comes up during the interview where you're just like, whoa, I didn't even know that. Okay, let's explore that for a while. But really, it's all about being as prepared as possible going into something. And then being flexible enough to throw it all out the window if cooler stuff comes up or it turns out your premise is wrong or anything else.
Got ya. This is funny. I mean, you're clearly, obviously, very well versed in interviews, and here I am doing my first one. Like, this is ridiculous.
You're doing very well.
You're like critiquing very well. You're like, in my class, you'd have a B+, maybe.
No. You're doing very well. This is, you know, the best interviews are when the person doing the interview is just interested and you're having a conversation. And I found when doing the film, my biggest fear was that the Kenner guys would kind of not really care. So I'd sit down and they'd answer their questions and that would be it. But what I discovered and what made me really happy was they were really enthusiastic. You know what I mean? Like, to them, on one hand, it was a job. You know, so I'd ask a question, they'd be like, man, I don't even remember. You know, it was 30 years ago, and it was just a gig. So I wasn't paying attention to this thing that you're asking me about. But at the same time, they were like, but yeah, we love doing this because it was Star Wars, and Star Wars was awesome, and we knew we were part of it, and we were really excited to be creating all these cool toys. And, you know, it wasn't just another fire truck or another whatever. It was like an X-Wing, which was different and exciting and interesting. And I found that was really cool because I didn't know how they'd feel. So it ended up being just a conversation. We're talking about this awesome stuff. And that was a huge relief. So, you know, whether it's your first one or your 100th or 1,000th interview, you always go in with your fingers crossed and hoping that, you know, it becomes something engaging.
Right. Well, we got a couple of questions from some of our listeners.
Sure.
I wanted to ask one of those. So our listener, Kenny Crowley Jr., wrote and he says, what was it like making this documentary and how much fun was it to tell the story of how the Star Wars toys came to be?
Well, I'm not exactly sure about, what does he mean by what was it like to make this documentary? So I'm just going to choose to interpret that as I want.
You have that freedom.
Yes, I have that power. Because by the time this airs, I'll be long gone.
Right.
It's funny because it was very conflicting in the sense that it was totally fun. Obviously, I'm meeting all these awesome people. I'm seeing all these awesome toys. I'm getting to talk and think and, you know, engage with this thing that I love, you know, Star Wars and Star Wars toys. So every conversation was something that I was into talking about. And I was having it with people who are into talking about it also. Unlike when I sit down with my wife, who is very tolerant of all my collecting, but, you know, she likes this stuff, but she's not going to, like, have a 3-hour conversation about Star Wars toys with me. So that was awesome. But at the same time, it was exhausting because it was such a long process. And, you know, 14 days on the road talking about Star Wars toys sounds like a lot of fun until you spend 14 days on the road lugging equipment, setting up interviews. Doing interviews is it sounds so easy. You're just hanging out and talking, but it's really not. You have to be listening and constantly thinking and constantly processing information. So it becomes very tiring. So that was a part of it that I kind of didn't see coming, how exhausting it would become. And then through it all was this lingering fear that what if I don't get this right? What if I put out something that the community that I'm a part of and that is important to me, what if they feel like I don't do the subject justice? Or, you know, I wasn't too worried about getting anything wrong. It was easy enough to check all the facts. But what if it just isn't good? And what if it's insulting or, you know, something like that? And what if I let down this community? I was really nervous about that, quite frankly, you know? And so that sort of pressure in the back of my head the whole time kept me awake at night sometimes. And it was, and especially in the beginning when I wasn't sure exactly what this movie was going to be. So that's what it's like. It's this weird mix of excitement, fun, and abject terror. If anyone's thinking of making a documentary, keep that in mind. Fear.
Yeah.
But it was mostly awesome. I should just say that. It was mostly awesome. So much fun.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like it would be fun. I mean, just the people you talk to, and hell, getting to see all those awesome collections must have been sweet.
You know, you had said something before. I forget how you worded it, but, you know, you go into someone's house and they have all this stuff you don't have, but you want. And you're just like, wow. You know, you stop short and just stare at it all. And you're like, holy cow, I am so jealous. And your little mental shopping list, you know, is getting longer and longer with every house you visit. Like, okay, I definitely want to get one of those. I definitely want to get one of those. And, oh man, I never saw one of those up close. Okay, I definitely want to get one of those. And you're just like, man, my budget for the film is whatever, but I just spent like an extra $700 because mentally I know I'm going to go home, jump on eBay and like try and find all this stuff. And then you go to someone like Gus's house where it's all prototypes. And I love prototypes and pre-production and stuff like that. So you see that and you're just like, your brain shuts down. You don't even know what to think. You're like, those are the coolest things I've ever seen. So that was always, that was both fun and incredibly depressing to see all this awesome stuff and know that, you know, you can't just sort of buy it all. So But it was still great to see.
That, yeah. There was one particular thing in the video I saw, and again, I don't remember the name of the guy's house you were at. It was one of the, I'm assuming he was just like a private collector, but he had on the back of his door, he had these two posters, and they were older posters. He had one, it says Tatooine, it's just a picture of Jabba's palace, and then the one below it just says Dagobah, and it's the scene of Dagobah Swamp from like right before Luke crash lands. And I love Dagobah. It's funny because my co-host always gives me hell for it because he's not a fan of Dagobah. I just love Dagobah. I love the mystique of that planet. And I love that particular print. It's just such a cool shot. I mean, it literally captures the... If you're a fan of Dagobah, it captures the mystique of Dagobah. And I saw it on the back of this guy's door. I'm like, damn, I really want that. When I was at Fan Days, the one in Dallas a couple years ago, there was somebody selling one. And, you know, they had it framed and everything. And it was in pretty good shape. I mean, the corners were a little banged up. But other than that, it was in really good shape. And what they were asking for, it was just a little bit out of my budget at the time.
Mm.
So, like, I went back the second day, and they still had it. And I was like, would you be able to, you know, come down a little bit? And they're like, you know what? Like, why don't you come back at the end of the day, right before we close out? And if I still have it, I can do it. So I got caught up doing something else. By the time I got back to that vendor stand, they were already packed up and gone.
Oh.
And I was like, damn. You know, and I tried Ouch. eBay and everything. I can't find the thing. So next time I was like, you know what? Even if that means not buying, like if I see this at a vendor at C7, if that means not eating dinner for the two nights, whatever. You know, like I got to get that print.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes, you know, look, as a collector, you have to weigh a lot. Unless you have unlimited funds, it's always... I like to say that being a collector is learning to live with regret, because no matter what you choose to buy, there's always a thing you can't get because you chose to buy something else. And like, you can't win. If there's three things in front of you that you want and you can only buy one of them, as happy as you'll be about the thing you got, you'll be twice as depressed about the two things you couldn't buy.
Yeah.
It's like, well, dude, you could have bought any of them. You picked the one you wanted. It's like, yeah, I should have gotten the other one. And you can't win.
Right.
So it's the nature of it. And sometimes, you know, it means you don't eat so you can get the thing you want and hope your friends will toss you some crackers that, like, come with their soup or something. And, you know, you do what you got to do.
Yeah.
But it's, yeah, you know. how could anyone make fun of you for liking Dagobah? I can understand if it's like, out of all the kind of planets and environments in Star Wars, maybe it's not your favorite, but
yeah.
But how could anyone come up with, like, what's there not, what about it would actually draw ridicule? like I could see it not being your number one sort of location, but
yeah.
How could it slip into the negative?
Yeah, I think
I don't quite understand that.
So it's actually like my co-host and I were very different. For, you know, everybody listening right now, they know this, but he's a huge prequel fan, and I'm more of the OT type of a guy. Not that neither of us like the other. I mean, I prefer the originals to the prequels, and he prefers the prequels to the originals, which is great. It makes for a great balance in the show. But he finds Dagobah just like, he says it's kind of spooky. You know, it's gross. It's a swamp. I mean, he appreciates it, but he'll pick on... Because I pick on him all the time for liking Jar Jar Binks.
Wait, how old is he?
He's 23 or 24, I believe. So he's much younger.
Okay, because I was going to say, if he's anywhere close to our age, that alone is grounds for, like, pitchforks and torches and my age.
I'm a little bit younger. I'm 28, so... but I was growing
up. Wow, I suddenly feel so old.
No.
Okay, keep going. Here we go.
But when I was growing up, it was right before the special editions came out. And this is actually, I'm just going to jump into it now. It doesn't go directly in line with the documentary, but, so I grew up with the Power of the Force 2 line, you know, in 95, 96 there. And I really liked, the perspective that your film gave it. Cause it's kind of like, you know, everybody was made all macho and stuff, which is true. But when I was growing up, I didn't see it that way. I just was like, these are so cool. And like, I had an uncle who, he's just a couple years older than you. When he was growing up, he had a bunch of the Star Wars toys, and he gave me a couple when I first started to like Star Wars from what he had left in his collection. I think I had like a Darth Vader with no working lightsaber and a stormtrooper, you know, from like the 70, the very first collection.
Yeah.
And like, it was cool when I got them, but then when that Power of the Force line came out, I was like, these are so much better. The colors are richer, like, they're way more movable, the weapons are really cool. And again, like, I'm getting out of place here, but whatever, since it's kind of on the topic. What is your opinion of the Power of the Force 2 line? Did you collect that line?
No, I was, so, by then, by 95, 96, I probably wasn't really collecting toys at that point. I'd started to get into music and things like that, so I was, at that point, probably buying synthesizers and stuff. But it's funny, I saw them come out, and I thought, huh, Star Wars toys. But it didn't really click, because by then, I'd already gone through a stage where I was into G.I. Joe and Transformers and all that stuff, like sort of the early 80s, because they landed right at that sweet spot, you know, when I was like 8, 9, 10 years old. And at the time, they just seemed way cooler to me than Star Wars toys. I loved Star Wars, but the toys weren't quite, and you weren't seeing them on the shelf quite as much by then, you know, by sort of the mid-80s and stuff like that. So by the time the Power of the Force 2 came out, I mean, I didn't even know Power of the Force existed. You know what I mean? Until I was much older, I didn't even know those toys ever came out at all. Like, completely escaped my frame of reference. So Power of the Force 2 came out, and I was already sort of so far out of an action figure kind of mindset that they just didn't even register. I was buying a lot of comics at the time, so I was really into comic books and things like that. Later on, when I sort of came upon them again and sort of understood what was going on, I do remember them looking a little strange. But again, my context was not the same as yours, you know, being immersed in it as they came out. I can completely understand why when you looked at them as a kid in the middle of it all, you didn't see anything unusual because it's of the moment, and it was very immediate. I think it's only people who grew up with the stuff beforehand or kind of discovered the Power of the Force 2 stuff much later where you have this kind of weird kind of meta context and you can look at it and say, that's kind of bizarre. You know, what's up with Leia's face and why is Han and Luke so muscular?
Yeah.
So I didn't have a strong opinion at the time. And today for a very, I'm going to be real sort of safe in my answer and just say, you know, if you like them, more power to you. I choose to not get too deep into it.
Oh, no, that's fine.
I don't want to piss off half the Star Wars community.
Oh, no. I'm
the crotchety old guy who's like, original trilogy and original line, and that's all I care about.
Yeah.
But the truth is, I look at a lot of the modern Star Wars toys that come out, and I am blown away by how detailed they are and all the characters that we never had in the original line of toys. Really, it took 20 years to get a Tarkin, you know, or whatever. It's like, come on, man. Yeah,
they never had a Grand Moff Tarkin back then.
No.
Wow, I didn't know that.
I've heard a lot of reasons for it. One of them that seems pretty likely is just likeness rights and stuff like that, and he didn't want to be involved. I've never gotten a definitive answer from anyone, but we never had a Tarkin.
Wow.
Only one of the, we had a Death Squad commander, but we didn't have a Tarkin. Like, what's up with that? So, I look at a lot of the modern stuff, and even though I have no interest in collecting it, I'm blown away by a lot of it. It's funny, I was down in Virginia, and I was at a collector's house. This wasn't for the film. This was after I was mostly done. He showed me a toy from the prequels. It was, I think it was the big transporter for the battle droids. And I remember seeing the prequels and seeing the stuff in it, not being that impressed. I was like, it's all okay. It just, you know, it's not my Star Wars, blah, 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 crotchety old man, get off my lawn type of thing. But then he showed me this toy, and I was like, okay, whatever. And like 10 seconds later, I was like, this is the coolest thing ever. You press a button and it opens up and all the droids are in here and it does this. And oh, wow, it's got these rockets and it makes all these noises. This is awesome. And I was like, wow, you know, whether I liked them in the movie or not, some of these toys are just killer.
Yeah.
So I, you know, it's amazing what can be done today. And, you know, now that it's all kind of in place.
Yeah. Yeah. Have you heard of the Black series that has just
came out? Oh, yeah.
Yeah. A guy who's been on our show a number of times who I met like at C6 and at Fan Days. He lives over in Norway. So he went to Celebration Europe. And I think they only released these at Celebration Europe, and then again they did have them at San Diego Comic Con. But the Boba Fett with Han Solo and Carbonite Black Series 6-inch.
Oh wow!
So he picked me one up over in Europe and shipped it to me, which was really nice to do. And dude, the detail on this thing is just unbelievable. I mean, Boba Fett's armor is perfect to a T.
The same sculpt as the Fett figure that's out?
Right now?
Now?
Yeah, it is. It is, which is why...
That thing's amazing.
It is,
I'm, like, blown away by it.
It's so cool. And the surprising thing with the Han Solo and Carbonite piece is it comes with a stand, so it's perfect. You can, you know, I mean, these figures are not really being sold for kids to play with. These are really being sold for display purpose. And, I mean, it just looks perfect standing the Fett right next to the Han Carbonite. The funny thing with the Han Solo and Carbonite, it's all plastic, but it's completely hollow. I mean, it looks really like thick. Like, mm-hmm. When you pick it up, it might be heavy. I mean, it probably weighs like a tenth of an ounce. I mean, it's so light. It's really cool.
Yeah, I mean, it costs about 10 cents to make.
Right.
And, you know, they're charging whatever they charge
for.
Yeah,
I mean, that was like $60. So.
Right, of course. But it's, you know, the articulation, the sculpts, everything else. Like, I have this fondness in my heart for the original figures because they're detailed enough where you know who and what they are, obviously, but they're not super accurate. You know, Luke, I mean, yeah, okay. It's almost like they get the sort of shorthand or the symbolic qualities of the figure. So Luke, he has, you know, a tunic, and he's got these tan pants, and he's got blonde hair. So that's sort of the symbol for Luke. It's like when you see green and purple, it's the Hulk, or the Joker, I guess. Mm. Or when you see red, yellow, and blue, Superman. There's a writer named Scott McCloud who wrote a book called Understanding Comics, and he talks about that, how these colors have become the symbolic shorthand for particular characters. And I think Kenner, in their approach to these figures, whether it was intentional or not, kind of zeroed in on the elements that let you know who they are. I mean, Princess Leia doesn't look like Carrie Fisher, but there's no mistaking that hair, you know, on the first Leia figure. You know, the cinnamon bun strapped to the side of her head. And the nice thing about that is I think it allowed kids to really imprint their imagination on these toys a little bit more, because it doesn't look exactly like the figure or like the characters, and more importantly, it doesn't look almost like the characters, because when you get too close, you fall into something called the uncanny valley. The uncanny valley says there is a point where something looks almost like a person, and we as humans sort of automatically recognize them as being Dave or Bill or Kate or whoever these people are. But it's not close enough, and that becomes creepy and weird, and it freaks you out. It's this uncanny valley. It's close enough to kind of see it, but not so close that your brain becomes comfortable with it. So I think the cool thing about those original Star Wars toys is that they maintained enough of a distance where it was never creepy and weird because your brain wasn't trying to reconcile it, and it was different enough where you kind of felt comfortable making these characters your own. And I don't think that was part of the plan, but I think it's a beneficial, unintended consequence of these kind of inaccurate sculpts. So I always kind of liked that about them. And I always sort of felt like, you know, Todd McFarlane, you know, McFarlane Toys started putting out these crazy accurate action figures in the 90s. And it was just like, wow, that is literally whoever it's supposed to be. And I kind of found it became harder to... I mean, I wasn't really playing with action figures at that point, but I felt like it was harder to engage them on this sort of imaginative level because it just looked too much like I was holding, you know, whoever, you know, Robert Downey Jr., like, but right. he's only 4 inches tall. It was, like, kind of freaking me out. So I have these sort of mixed feelings about the super accurate versus the kind of not even close, like, what is this weird blob of plastic with yellow hair?
Yeah.
That said, I think the Fett figure, I think anything in, like, a costume is killer when it's accurate. Like, the Stormtroopers, like, the Biker Scout, I think, is great, and I think the Fett is great. I actually really love the X-Wing Luke in the Black Series. I think that figure's amazing. Something about it really kind of clicked with me.
Did you have you bought any of those?
I have not.
Okay.
But the X-Wing Luke is the one that I came closest to pulling the trigger on. I thought it would be R2, but I was strangely disappointed by R2 because the construction of it was not as sort of precise as I want it to be. I mean, it looks good in all the photos, and then when I saw the actual figure, I'm like, the legs look a little weirdly, like the plastic starts to bend a little bit, mm-hmm. like these little things. It's a problem R2, like almost every R2 I've ever seen seems to have. It's hard to make it, I don't know, have that sort of heft that I want it to have.
You got you. Yeah, I understand.
But yeah, I think those figures are great. Love the articulation.
Yeah. I've only gotten, you know, the Boba Fett with the Han Solo, and then I actually did get the R2-D2. That's the only ones I've gotten. But they are, you know, they're definitely great. I have another question from, sure. from one of our listeners. Leon355 over on Twitter, he says, were you surprised by anything that you found out while making this documentary, and will there be a sequel?
Oh, man. Okay.
By the way, these, like, the people on our page that have responded to this stuff, like, people loved it, man. So, I mean, you did a damn good job.
So, everyone asked me if there's been a sequel. They asked me, you know, on Facebook, everywhere else, Rebel Scum, and I see this. And I think I wrote on Rebel Scum that I dare all the people who are asking about a sequel to ask me to my face. Because the very thought of it makes me kind of start twitching. It was so much work. I was so exhausted by the end of it that ask me to do a sequel, you better give me a couple beers at the same time or else I'm going to, like, probably freak out. I'm probably not going to do a sequel. However, we have a ton of stuff that never made it into the film, and I'll definitely be cutting that and putting it online over the next year, 2 years, however long it takes me to kind of get it all out. So, not a sequel, but lots of extra material that'll be on our website, just giving it away. I'm cutting together a small little mini feature that was supposed to be an extra but didn't make it into it on bootlegs, because that's just a fascinating kind of side to the Star Wars world. All the vintage bootlegs that are out there. So that'll be coming out. So there's definitely more stuff, but not a sequel per se. As far as surprises go, it's something actually that comes up a lot, a question that I get a lot. And on one hand, the story, like we all, well, maybe not everybody, but if you've read Sansweet's book, if you've talked to certain people, you kind of know the story. It's out there. So in that regard, there weren't any surprises, but there were a lot of little details that I found surprising. For instance, the troop transport, I had no idea that the reason it existed was because they wanted to maintain a relationship with the Ozen Sound Company, and they made the little talking box, and Ozen wanted in on this whole Star Wars thing, so Kenner said, okay, we'll come up with something. And they ended up with a troop transport. So I certainly didn't know that, and that was kind of a fun sort of thing to learn. I didn't know at the time that the... until I started doing research, I didn't know that the original Ewok Village model was literally made out of sticks and twigs and grass and bark and stones. When someone finally told me that, I was sort of amazed. And then I didn't think I'd get to see it. And then I didn't think I'd get to interview the guy who actually made the thing. So that was all kind of surprising. So those type of things popped up a lot. Half the stuff in the film on that level, I didn't know that they, at least for 10 minutes, considered an R2 choo-choo, which
was
an insane concept. you know, it didn't stand a chance, but, you know, it things like that I didn't know about. So yeah, it's all that stuff was sort of was new to me.
That's great. Now you kind of hinted at it earlier, and I'm curious if it indeed is your favorite. I'm just curious, what was your favorite Star Wars toy growing up?
Yeah, it was the troop transport. You know, for me, it wasn't in the movie, but I was kind of too young to question that. You know what I mean? Like, I was too young to see any problem with there being a toy that didn't also exist in the movie. I just figured it's just a Star Wars thing. There wasn't that kind of one-to-one connection that would even occur to me. But the thing I loved about it was, you know, people talked about how if you had the, like, C-3PO figure, it was like, yeah, I have this piece of Star Wars. I have this little connection to Star Wars. Well, with the troop transport, that thing talked. So you didn't just have the kind of representation of C-3PO in your living room. You kind of had the character literally there, because here's his voice. It's coming out of this box. I mean, I didn't think there was a tiny Anthony Daniels shoved in there. I wasn't, you know, I was young, but I wasn't insane. But it was this, like, further connection to Star Wars that went beyond just some plastic figure where your friend was kind of trying to make up a C-3PO voice. It's like, well, that's great, but when I press this button, there it is. And as a kid, that just completely blew me away. Plus, I thought it was cool looking, and, you know, you could put all your figures in it, or eight of them, plus a couple in that back piece. So, yeah, I love that toy. I also really love the Power Droid for some reason. It clicked when you moved the feet. I thought, you know, as a 4-year-old or a 5-year-old, I thought, well, hey, that's the height of technological innovation right there. I liked the R2 figure a lot because the head clicked, and it was this cool little sort of compact little robot. I thought that was wild. R5-D4, one of my favorite figures as a kid for the same reason. And I really like the orange and white. It's nothing like R5 in the movie. But to me, that's always what he's going to look like. So every time I see the movie, I'm like, Lucas got it wrong, which makes no sense. But
Kenner made this.
Right. Like, what are they? Didn't they pay attention? Come on. I love the X-Wing. As a kid, I had that, and that was awesome. I think those were my favorites as a kid. Yeah, those are the ones I remember playing with the most.
Nice. Now, when you were, I mean, this dates back to, like, when you were a kid or even now, mm-hmm. but probably more specifically when you were a kid, because you played with them probably then. But was there any particular Star Wars toy you wanted that they didn't make?
It's a good question. Was there anything that I wanted that they didn't make? I remember being kind of confused by the Star Destroyer playset, because it didn't look anything like a Star Destroyer. It was this weird pie-shaped wedge that didn't even look like a ship. It looked like a gazebo or something. It was open on all the sides, and I couldn't understand it at all. And I remember thinking, what a bummer. Like, I want a Star Destroyer. I mean, it's going to be 14 feet long or something, but man, that would be awesome. Some sort of Star Destroyer that actually looked like a ship, not this weird chunk of a room or a tent or something. Like, I couldn't process it. I still can't process it. To me, it's still, like, kind of one of the lamest things out there, because it's such a, like, kind of a half-hearted attempt. And I understand that the Kenner guys couldn't make this huge freaking Star Destroyer, but they could have made some sort of weird mutated version that was maybe the size of, like, the Falcon or something. Like, yeah. Clearly not correct, but at least identifiable as a Star Destroyer.
Yeah.
I don't know. So I do kind of remember being confused by it. But beyond that, I don't think so. There's so much stuff. You know, I didn't have time to be disappointed that anything else wasn't there.
Sure. Yeah, in regards to the Star Destroyer, it would have been cool. Like, I remember when I was growing up, my older brother was a big Star Trek fan, and you know, that's when Next Generation was on TV and stuff, and he had like the bridge playset, which was awesome. Mm-hmm. Like, everything was perfect in scale for the action figures. I just thought it'd be cool if they did that with the Star Destroyer, or specifically like the Executor, just build the bridge, you know, like with the gangplank and the crew pit and the big windows. You could have your Vader figure there. Like, I thought that would be really cool.
Yeah. You know what? That would have been fine. Just anything. I don't remember as a kid being like angry about it. Like today, I'm probably a little bit angry about it because it seems like such a missed opportunity. But as a kid, I was just confused. I couldn't understand. I was like, but this is not a Star Destroyer. Like, my brain couldn't put the two together, couldn't reconcile these two kind of dichotomous elements. Like, what a Star Destroyer is supposed to be and this thing that, like, they're showing me I get. I'm like, what? Yeah. Doesn't work.
Well, we actually, the last question from one of our listeners.
Sure.
This is a guy named Joe Hogan. Joe Hogan is actually, he's an awesome guy. He's been on our show a bunch, and he actually does all the artwork for us for our, like, podcast page and stuff.
Awesome.
So this is kind of like an artist question to an artist, which is cool. He says, it's clear that, you know, as somebody who made a Star Wars collecting documentary, he imagines you're a collector yourself. So what's the most personal and important Star Wars piece in your collection, and why?
That's a good question, too. I wish I could say it was a piece that I had, like, from when I was a kid. Like, literally a piece that I'd held on to. But unfortunately, all my toys as a kid have disappeared over the years. I know I sold a lot of them at, like, yard sales when I was a little kid. There were a few that I was hoping were still at my grandmother's house, because she had a few toys that were there for when I would come and visit. So I was so hopeful that maybe, like, I had an X-Wing there, and I know I had a Luke X-Wing figure, a couple other things, but can't find them. I've turned that house inside out looking for them. So I can't say it's something like that. But for me, they're kind of a couple pieces that are really important to me because they, you know, have connections to when I was a kid, but also there are a couple pieces that are important to me because of how I view Star Wars today and what I find interesting about it today, which is a little bit different than what I found interesting about it as a kid. Obviously, I have different perspective on it. But the Power Droid figure is really something that was important to me that I get. When I first got back into Star Wars toys, I said, I have to get one of these. Because I loved it as a kid, and it's one of those figures that every time I look at it, as sort of dorky a figure as it is, this weird little blue box with a sticker on the front, I can't help but sort of conjure up those feelings I had from when I was a little kid. And related to it, I have a pre-production piece for the Power Droid. I have a first shot, which is kind of an early, later stage of the pre-production process. First shots were used kind of to test the molds in the factory and stuff like that, and they're a little different than the versions that went out to the public. They don't have date information stamped onto them yet. They don't have country of origin stamps on them. And in the case of my Power Droid, the sticker is hand-cut. It's not stamped out and die-cut by a machine. So that's kind of important to me because it's that connection to this figure I loved as a kid. And then as an adult, it's something that I really love because it's that behind-the-scenes process, you know, and that kind of that peek behind the curtain, you know, to see the Wizard of Oz, you know, hiding back there, to see how it's all done. That's why I love prototypes and pre-production, and here it is of my favorite piece as a kid. So that's really important to me. The other one that's really important to me is I have an early bird set, the four figures and the little tray, and mine's the double telescoping Luke. And that's important to me because that is, in many ways, the thing that kind of transformed it all. I mean, I suppose the early bird envelope as well, but those figures, in that case, that kind of mailer, it pretty much was the moment when everything changed. And it really gets to the heart of, like, as a symbol for me, of the sort of amazingness of Star Wars toys. Like, this innocent little thing. There's so much history tied to it. And then the last one is the regular old R2. Just straight up Kenner, you know, 2-inch tall figure. Because that's the thing that got me back into these toys. And I actually have a few of them. You know, I have a really, really clean one that's on display, and I have one that's kind of messed up, because that's the one I bought at this comic book show after having seen it in that store, Love Saves the Day. I bought, like, a less expensive one. It was a little not in great condition, but I love it, because that's the one that sort of launched me on this whole crazy sort of journey. So there are other toys in my collection that mean a lot to me, and I really love, but those particular things have an emotional kick to them that that others don't. Even some of technically cooler things that I have, that I even think are cooler, but they don't have that little magic kind of something attached to them.
Awesome. I'm just curious, you know, now, like, after, you know, bringing up the Power of the Force line stuff and all that, and, you know, we mentioned a little bit about Black Series, what do you think of the, you know, the kind of the evolution of Star Wars toys? So, like, let me preface with, when I picked up your documentary, again, like I said, I wasn't sure what it was going to be exactly about. I just knew it was something about Star Wars toys, and I was like, sweet, that's going to be awesome. Because I think for any person who loves Star Wars, there is some connection to Star Wars toys. I think that's part of the reason people fell so in love with Star Wars is because we had this outlet through which we could continue that creative process. And, you know, and that was the beauty of Star Wars toys. And you kind of hit on that point at the beginning of your film. But, you know, I wasn't sure if this was going to be, like, kind of charting the history of, like, Star Wars toys from 1977 to 2005 or something. So, again, like, I mean, I was extremely happy with what it was. I mean, because that was a story I wasn't even remotely aware of. But just now, like, stepping back to, like, look at this evolutionary process of, kind of like you said, I mean, you pick up a Han Solo action figure now, I mean, it looks just like Harrison Ford. You know, I mean, there's, whereas if you know, you pick up the Han Solo and Bespin outfit from 1981, like, it's extremely different. I mean,
or you pick up the original Star Wars figure, like the first 12, I mean, he's got two different size heads, neither of which look like Harrison Ford.
Right.
So,
yeah. I mean, so what do you think of this? I mean, obviously it's kind of an open, ambiguous question, but, like, what do you think of how they've evolved? I mean, what do you think that says about Star Wars fans, collectors, or anything really? I mean, what do you think about all that? How different they are?
I think in a lot of ways it's an acknowledgement. I mean, I can only speak from my own kind of experiences and kind of just my interpretation of things. You know, a guy at Hasbro might be able to sort of give you literally what's going on, but to me it seems like it kind of represents two things that are happening. One, there is maybe more than two things, I should say. But on one hand, it's an acknowledgement of collectors. You know what I mean? There are toys coming out that are pretty expensive for an action figure, and they're very articulated, they're very detailed, more so than I think a little kid might care about. And they're clearly aimed at people who grew up with these toys and are still collecting them today. Or maybe they didn't grow up with them and they're collecting them today. But either way, they're collectors. They're adults. They have a little more money to spend. They want something that'll look good on a shelf. And I think that's fine. I think that's awesome. I think, though, that's recognizing that market, which just did not exist when these toys originally came out. It was the farthest thing from anyone's mind. So what you're seeing is this sort of shift in the way toy companies are looking at the available markets and a shift in the markets themselves. Another thing that I think is sort of can be read from the development of the toys is that kids themselves are still into this stuff. You know what I mean? and there's a enough out there that kids will find attractive. You know, they're not quite as expensive. They're, you know, more posable, less posable, whatever. So it's recognizing that that market still exists. I think there another aspect of it is this sort of understanding that the toy, the manufacturing process, the techniques are different, and they allow for better sculpts and better reproduction of detail and whatever, better paints and all these sort of things. So there's that sort of shift in the technology that is visible when you chart the earliest days of Star Wars toys to the current state of Star Wars toys. You can see this developing tech. The effects are better. You know, it's no longer just a weird little buzzing noise. It's a voice chip, you know, all these different things to make the sounds. And finally, I think one of the things you can sort of understand from looking at these toys is the machine is in place. You know, when the first wave of Star Wars figures came out, everyone was kind of flying by the seat of their pants. And that's one of the reasons I focused the story of the film on that first line of toys, the original line of toys, because nobody quite knew what they were doing. Kenner didn't know what they were doing yet with this line. They didn't know what would be successful or not. Lucasfilm didn't know what would be successful or not. You know, audiences didn't know what they were in for. It was all kind of winging it. Like Gus Lopez says in the film, it wasn't until Jedi that Kenner really got it right. Or I should say, knew what they were doing and could plan to get it right instead of just lucking out, basically. Nowadays, everyone knows how it works. They know how licensing works. They know how many toys to produce. They know what time frame to produce it in. They can predict what will... you know, what needs to be done, when it needs to be done in order to sort of get whatever market share they need to achieve. The lines of distribution are in place. The stores know how much they're going to order because they know what's going to be successful and what's not going to be successful. It's all there, and it's just a matter of filling in the blanks. Well, which figure will it be? What innovation can we maybe bring out this time so that we can, you know, launch a new line? It's established. And that's less interesting to me from a narrative point of view, but it is fascinating to me to think about that transition. And I think all that can be sort of identified by seeing the toy line today versus the toy line back then. And it's not a negative thing, but it's just they've figured it out by now. You know, they know how it works. So there's a lot of things that can be read by kind of looking at the full scope of the line. You're getting a little bit of a rambling answer because I'm kind of putting this together in my head as I'm saying it.
That's fine.
It's kind of a big question
that I just threw at you, so that's fine.
Well, no, but I think it's an interesting thing, and I think anyone interested in toys, it's sort of a fascinating thing to explore. I think there's something else going on, though, that, you know, I didn't really get into in the film, but it's kind of a bigger toy discussion. The people who made the original Star Wars toys were industrial designers and graphic designers. They weren't necessarily toy people. They got into that field because there were jobs there. You know, Tom Troy told me that originally he wanted to design cars. That's where, like, all the designers wanted to go. That was the cool thing to design. And toys were a little bit like, oh, okay, you're doing toys. But he loved Star Wars, so he was perfectly happy to be there. But I think today, you know, the people designing the toys are the kids who grew up with the toys, and it's a completely different attitude. It's like, wow, I get to work in the toy industry. I get to make toys. I get to create these amazing things. And I think that plays into the type of toys we're getting today, where there is a level of sort of sophistication to them, even for the stuff that's going to go to little kids, because the people making them have this true and deep love of toys. Toys are the point. It's not just, well, I'll design anything. It's like, no, I want to design toys. And that's something you can kind of see when you look at the nature of the toys today versus the nature of the toys back then, I think. Which isn't to say that people back then didn't love designing toys. There are people, but some of the ones I spoke to said that wasn't what they initially set out to do, and something they kind of fell into and then fell in love with. And then it became their careers forever. I mean, they did love it. So it's all part and parcel of this thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But you know, one thing I think that has, I mean, is like you kind of already mentioned, you know, the articulation, the detail has certainly become far greater than anything you would have thought of in 1977. Mm-hmm. But one thing I think has definitely kind of sucked since the early figures, and this is something you guys go over a little bit in your film, is the card back. You know, I mean, I heard it, you know, from people in your film. I've heard it from, you know, other podcasters I've talked to that are, you know, older than I am, who are, you know, grew up with the Star Wars movies, the originals. But there was something really awesome about those card backs, just the design of them and the picture, you know, the huge picture. Because, you know, obviously back then you didn't have this easy access like we have today to being able to see the films or anything like that. So this kind of became a way of being able to possess scenes of the film. Mm. You know, and I think the card backs that they make now, for the most part, I think they kind of suck. They're really boring. And that's why I really liked when they redid the vintage line. I don't know if you were familiar with that, you know. I mean,
yeah, absolutely.
You know, yeah, and like, you know, they kind of redid those card backs. That was my favorite thing about the darn figure. You know, even though the figures look, you know, obviously way more detailed than they did in the 80s and 70s, the card, it was just so cool to get that card back. So I was, you know, just curious what your thoughts were of, you know, those old card backs.
I love them. I mean, I think that, you know, I can only talk about them sort of with this context of looking at them today, because as a kid, I thought they were cool because you get this great big photo. But as an adult, there are so many other things that I find really awesome about them. I mean, the thing about it is those photos were all airbrushed, like so much. When you look at the original photo, or if you look at the scene in the film that the photo is taken from, there's all this other stuff in the background. Then you look at the card, you're like, wait a minute, it's just this like purple wall. Like I'm looking at a card for a Power Droid right now. I have proof cards from Power Droid. I have a 20 back proof card and a revenge proof card, which obviously they never released it as Revenge of the Jedi, but proof cards got out there, and proof cards are the literally the things that would come back from the printer for the people at Kenner to kind of look at and just say, okay, looks good. And, you know, then they'd throw them away. But today they're these sort of rare collectibles, and I think they're really cool. But I'm looking at it right now, and I'm like, you can, once you sort of know what to look for, you can see all the airbrushing. And the cumulative effect of this airbrushed art is to create kind of this new visual vocabulary, I think, that you didn't see as often then. Like it ends up creating this kind of unique work of art that I find really cool. It's like half photo, half like weird, literally airbrushing, like spray paint and masking. So it's like slightly artificial looking. And as a kid, I never picked up on it. I just didn't even click. But as an adult, and as someone who worked in publishing and worked in magazines and stuff, I can totally see it. I'm like looking at it right now. I'm like, that's not purple light. They painted that purple. So it's this kind of weird rotoscoping effect or something, like totally bizarre, but totally iconic. And I think a lot of the charm for me today comes from that. Plus you have these iconic things like the racetrack around the edge and the logo and the colors they used, like for the little box behind the figure or little box where the name is, you know, in that little pillbox area. And then you have like the offer on the front with this cool, like starburst shaped thing, you know, free Boba Fett. It's, to me today, this kind of awesome, you know, Bobby Sharp says it in the film, it's become pop art. And I think that's true. But that's obviously something that I didn't see as a kid. I just saw like, oh, awesome, there's like my favorite figure, my favorite character. There's Power Droid, there's Luke, there's whoever. So there's sort of a lot going on there. And I love the old stuff for that. I don't pay as much attention to the new things because they're just not quite on my radar. But I do like some of it. I mean, that quality isn't there, obviously, and you don't necessarily get the big scene. They were doing a lot of illustrated art for a while, but I kind of dig illustration art, so I thought it was always kind of fun to see just a cool painting of a ship or whatever. But it wasn't quite the same. Like you said, you have literally like a still from the movie, you know, in your hands, and I always thought that was kind of cool. Not entirely sure I answered your question.
Oh, yeah, you definitely did. And I thought it was, it's so clever, too, how, you know, they would use the card back as further marketing, too. You know, it's like, all, 53, or collect, they kept adding up as each, wave came out. But, like, to some degree, from a marketing standpoint, and I mean, I have no background in marketing, but from a marketing standpoint, I mean, that's just pure genius. You're showing all the other products in your line.
Bobby Sharp says, it says collect all 21. It doesn't ask you to, it tells you to.
Right.
And like when he said that to me, that's like the moment when as a journalist, you're like, cool, I can go home now. Done. That was the greatest line ever. That should be on a t-shirt. And it's true. It was this sort of great marketing angle that was participatory. You know what I mean? So as a kid, you're not just having someone scream at you, buy this thing, buy this thing, buy this thing. It's something you could circle and scratch off. It was like a list that was in your hands, and you could use it. It was like a tool. G.I. Joe did it with their figures also, afterwards. And it was a brilliant idea. I think Matchbox Cars did that too, though, someone told me. Like, I think there were other toys that set that precedent, but certainly never on the scale that Star Wars did. I mean, man, they really nailed it.
Yeah, when I was growing up, my older cousin had all the Return of the Jedi trading cards from 1983. Mm-hmm. They were the red-rimmed ones, because I know they always made blue-rimmed and then red-rimmed. But, they gave you the one card that listed every single card. And it's funny, he gave me the entire set, but it was kind of cute how, like, that one card with, the list of all the cards, he had checked off all the ones that he had. What a great way of putting it is, it's very participatory. Like, you're inviting the consumer to say, hey, which ones don't you have? This is what you're on the hunt for. And that's an exciting thing for a kid, too. I mean, I can remember.
Absolutely.
In 95, 96, I begging my mom to take me to Toys R Us, like, every other weekend, and calling ahead to the store to make sure they had, do you have Lando Calrissian? And, sending, some probably 45-year-old woman who's like, what the hell's a Lando Calrissian? looking through the Star Wars, I'd be, yeah, we have it. And I'd always be like, can you hold me one? I'd get in and, I'd pick it up at the front desk and I'd go back to look at what else was on the shelf. And it's like, there's 20 Landos there. And it's like, okay, I didn't need to do that. But,
you never know, though.
Right. But like just that excitement of, going in and getting the next one is like when you're a kid, it's not even about, or at least not for me. And I know some people were different. Some people were like, even as kids, they were like, I had to have them all just because you wanted as much as you could. Same, like, when I was a kid, like, I just knew that I couldn't have them all. I didn't have the money. My family wasn't going to give me a ton of money to go buy Star Wars toys. But, like, whichever one I could get to add to my story made it so exciting. So anything you could bring in just added to it. So it wasn't so much like, I have to go get these because I need to have them. It was just, oh, wow, they just came out with another Han Solo. Well, he's my favorite character. I got to go get that so I can play with him in a new scenario. Like, oh, Han and Hoth gear, great. Now I can take him out in the snow,
And at the same time, though, Kenner was the only company up to that point, as far as I know, who with each successive wave would re-release that original figure. So if you got into these toys with ESB, you could still get that first Farm Boy Luke, and it would just be on the Empire Strikes Back card. And I think for kids, I think in terms of the popularity of the line, that was pretty important. That ability to, it was always in print, so to speak. You know what I mean? Like, the figures didn't get retired. At the same time, the one thing they didn't do that they do all the time now is, you got a couple different versions of Han, a couple different versions of Luke and whatever, but like Vader, Chewie, the Stormtrooper, almost 3PO, I mean, they had the removable limb ones, but all those figures never changed. Vader was always Vader. He didn't get different poses. He didn't get anything. Yeah. So to a certain extent, as a kid, you didn't have to buy like 14 different Darth Vaders. You're kind of set if you had the one. Of course, collectors now found ways to buy as many as possible because, the COO is different, or this one is whatever, it's the Lily Letty, it's from Mexico or wherever. But at the time, I think it was this easily collectible thing for a long time for kids. Now it's impossible. It's so many different things. Sansweet, maybe a couple other people can pull it off, but most of us, I think it's unattainable.
Yeah. I just have a couple more questions, if you don't mind.
Sure, sure.
And again, this is something that's kind of covered at the beginning of your documentary to a certain degree, and you give lots of different perspectives from, you know, different collectors, but I kind of want to just get your perspective because you're the filmmaker here. But what do you think was the mass appeal of these Star Wars toys? You know, I mean, it back then and even today, you know, what is this huge appeal with Star Wars toys?
Well, I think, you know, on a fundamental level, they're awesome. You know what I mean? Like, it sounds flip to say that, but I think it's true. As a kid, what's cooler than, like, a Stormtrooper figure? Maybe the Boba Fett figure, or maybe the Vader figure. You know what I mean? But they're all Star Wars figures, and they're all, like, kind of not your run-of-the-mill toy. So what little kid's not going to love that? And then, more than that, it's a piece of this the most amazing movie that anyone had seen at that point, especially if you were a kid. And you get to take a piece of it home with you. You get to relive the adventure whenever you want and create your own adventures. And so I think that right there was a huge part of why it was so popular. It was Star Wars, and it was in your living room, and it was awesome and amazing, and you could do anything with it. And then as adults, I think they remain popular for similar reasons. Obviously, you might not be playing with them, but they represent Star Wars, which presumably we all love. They're cool figures, so it's like, hey, if you're going to put a piece of plastic on your shelf, you might as well put a cool one, whether it's a vintage one or a modern one. Doesn't matter. If you think it's cool, you think it's cool. And then throw in the nostalgia for it. You know, it's the things that I had as a kid, and it was such a huge part of my life. That, you know, that's a strong, strong sort of force, no pun intended, but, you know, to get us to love these things. So, yeah, I mean, I think their appeal is pretty straightforward. I mean, it's a toy. The appeal is straightforward for a little kid. It's an awesome thing to play with. There's no kind of other layers going on there when you're 8 years old. And I think we add those layers as we get older, or we recognize some of those layers as we get older. But at their core, they're fun to play with. You know, some people say, like, come on, man, they're just toys. You know, even people who love them, it's like, don't get so bent out of shape, it's just a toy. And I think that's sort of a silly point of view to take on a certain level, because, yes, technically they're just toys, but they have a history, and they have all these things that have made them more than toys for us today. And to discount that, I think, is sort of, it's willfully naive. Mm. But from a kid's point of view, yeah, they're just toys. So the toy is cool, or the toy is not cool. And if the toy is cool, you've got a hit. So from a kid's point of view, that's all there is to it, man.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, yeah, I mean, I totally agree. You're right. I mean, because as a kid, you're right, the appeal is it's a fun toy. And,
yeah,
you know.
And you can relive the event. I mean, yeah. Man, it's fun for a million different reasons. Yeah, it's Star Wars.
Yeah, yeah. Great. Now, I'm just curious, was there anything anything you wanted to cover in the film that you just weren't able to, or you just didn't have time for? This may be a good question, but.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I would have loved to have been able to travel all over Europe and really dig into the whole foreign side of things, but that just wasn't going to happen. And there are a lot of toys that I left out, and a lot of sort of aspects of the line that are not there. You know, it really doesn't get into the 12-inch line. It really doesn't get into die-cast. It really doesn't get into all these sort of things, because at some point, as a filmmaker, you have to draw a line, and you have to say, where does the narrative really lie? And what do I think is cool, but in reality is kind of just not really part of the story? And I wasn't really sure where to draw that line until I stopped and said, okay, when we're looking at the toys and we're trying to discuss why they were popular back then and why they're still popular today, The truth is, it all comes down to the 3¾-inch figures, the vehicles, and the playsets, and stuff like that. I mean, yeah, you might have loved those 12-inch figures as a kid, but the reality is, those were an aspect that were cool, but they didn't really contribute to the popularity of the line. That's not the thing that Kenner chose to keep making, and there's a reason for it. They didn't sell the same way that the others did. So when you're trying to point to what made this line the thing that it was, this great huge thing that's bigger than the sum of its parts, it's the basic action figures, the vehicles, and the playsets, that part of the line. And once I kind of came to that conclusion, I said, okay, that's where the story needs to focus. The other things were kind of spin-offs of that, in a way. I mean, yeah, the 12-inch figures came out at the same time as the original action figures, but they were, they're like a side branch of the main thing. That's why we made the micros an extra. I think the story of the micros is one of the most fascinating aspects of Star Wars. Here's a line that they put out that survived less than a year, and that flopped so fundamentally that they turned off production of them. Like, it was like stopping, it's like stop, if you stop talking in mid-sentence. They made so many prototypes of things that were gonna come out that were so close to being done. Figures for the micro line that got, they were made. All they had to do was be painted, and they just stopped. And that cost a fortune to get things that far, and they just ended it. That's astonishing to me. Like, what a self-destructive sort of event. But it's because it was this aborted time toy line, it clearly wasn't part of the story of why these toys are so popular. Because if they weren't popular, and they weren't part of it. So we made it an extra. But if I had my way, realistically, I might have gone back to explore some of that other stuff, but I don't know if the film would have been watchable. There's only so much you can cram in there before it only appeals to hardcore fans. So you know, it's hard to say if there are things that I didn't include that I would have included. There are things that I would have loved to talk about, but I'm not sure they really would have been successful if inserted into the movie. And there are all these people out there right now who are going to listen to this who love the 12-inch line or the die-cast line or anything else, and they're going to be like, no, it should have been there. That would have made it awesome. Your movie sucked without it. That's my favorite toy that you just totally, like, you know, just removed from your movie, to which I can only say I apologize, but... Can't fit everything. So, I don't know.
Well, that's awesome, man. You know, Brian, I really appreciate you coming to Beyond. But you know, before I end it, I got to know. This has nothing to do with your film. we seldom have people on the show that we actually really interview. I mean, even when we have like friends come on and stuff, we tend to ask this question just because I'm always very curious. So actually, our podcast was born from Fan Days in Dallas a couple of years ago. That's where I met my co-host and just kind of spewed from there. You know, never knew the guy beforehand, and it just everything happened to fall into place. But while I was awesome. Out there at Fan Days, I had never done a Star Wars convention in my life, nothing like this, never in my life. Mm-hmm. And it was a blast. I didn't know anybody when I went out there. I mean, I knew of a couple people, but never met anyone. But I was known as the guy who asked the same question to everyone I met, just because I was sincerely curious. And I was asking everybody, what's your favorite Star Wars movie? And that's the question I ask you. What's your favorite Star Wars movie?
Star Wars.
Okay.
The first one. Not A New Hope, Star Wars. No, that's okay. That's
you are an OT man. No,
that is a crotchety old man coming through. The truth is, whether you call it A New Hope or not, whether you're talking about 1977 or 1979 or whatever, that's my favorite movie. I think that in some ways, Empire is a better film, like from just sort of a technical point of view. But my favorite, the one I will watch over and over and over and over and over and over and over again, is Star Wars. It has a beginning, it has a middle, it has an end, it has this great story of this kid who starts on the farm and ends up the hero. And ultimately, that's kind of like the arc of the three movies, but because Lucas didn't know if there'd be a sequel, you got to kind of put it all in the first movie, at least in like a small scale. And you had it. You had everything. You had robots. You had aliens. You had spaceships. You had lightsabers, which are by far the absolute coolest thing ever invented. You have, you know, the baddest of the bad villains. You had this sort of starry-eyed young hero. You had a totally hot princess, even if she did have strange hair. And that's coming from someone who was, like, in the punk scene and stuff, so I know from strange hair, and nothing's weirder than those, like, cinnamon buns. But, man, I just love that movie so much.
That's great. You know, I think that's often the case of most people that grew up with them, because that's what started it all, and it was just such an immensely different film from everything at the time.
Yeah. Well, but I was too young to fully recognize that, but it's just...
Sure. Oh, yeah.
It's just like a thrill ride from the beginning to the end. You know what I mean? Like, you watch it and you're like, okay, I want to go do that. I want to go rescue someone from the Death Star.
Yeah.
I also love, and this is a little bit more as an adult, I love how different Vader was. Like, Vader was not the top of the heap of bad guys, you know? I mean, okay, yeah, Grand Moff Tarkin is above him. Like, fine, okay, fine, he's the Moff. But you have people talking back to Vader, where if they'd done this, you know, holding her could be dangerous. Yeah, if he'd said that in Empire, he'd be force-choked. He'd be dead. It'd be over, and someone else would be replacing him. But in Star Wars, Vader was kind of just this guy. He's a total badass.
Yeah.
But he was not the pinnacle of it all. And I find that fascinating. He's just a dude who will mess you up. But... And he's mysterious, you know what I mean? It wasn't just this sort of, you know, overly wrought bad guy. He was, man, you just didn't quite know what his deal was. I thought that was cool. As a kid, I thought he was a robot. I thought the stormtroopers were all robots. As a little kid, I didn't quite understand as a dude in a suit. I mean, the character was a guy in a suit. I knew there was an actor in the suit, but
right.
I was sort of, like, I was really confused. I remember being really confused when Luke and Han dress up as stormtroopers. I'm like, wait a minute. How'd they get all the robot parts out of the stormtrooper? And that's when I started to understand. I was like, oh, wait a minute. There's like a dude in that suit? Whoa, what's their story, man? That must be awesome. That was before the whole clone thing, which, whatever. There are dudes in those suits, man, and they clearly never had rifle practice because they can't hit anything. And they're just like, they're stormtroopers. They're supposed to be like the most badass, like, you know, army in the galaxy, and like, man, they suck, but they look awesome. So just everything about it. You know, I just, yeah, man, love that movie.
Yeah. I mean, what's not to love? I mean, so, well, Brian, I'm going to stop wasting your evening with, I could probably ask you like 30 more questions, but,
I'm having a great time. So I appreciate, you know, I appreciate you giving me all this time, so don't sweat it, man. It was great.
My pleasure. Before we go, I'd obviously like to give you the opportunity to, you know, give a shout-out to your film, Plastic Galaxy, and, you know, if people want to, you know, get in touch with you or get in touch with, you know, aspects of the film, you know, want to order a copy, which, by the way, if you haven't ordered a copy, get your act together and get this film. It's amazing. you're only shortchanging yourself. But Brian, anybody that wants to get the film or get in touch with you to find out how to get in touch with the film, how can they do that?
The best thing to do is go to our webpage, and it's plasticgalaxymovie.com. And you can order the film from there and whatever. In the coming months, we will be posting like all sorts of cool behind the scenes photos, and, you know, our logo has gone through like 100 different stages of evolution. So we'll be posting like some of like weird design stuff and little clips and things. That's where they'll all be sort of living. And then you can also find out more info and like sort of get in on the conversation at our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/plasticgalaxy. Perfect. Pretty much the usual social media routes.
Right.
You know, right. It's all, we've figured it all out by now.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know what, Brian, I mean, I appreciate you so much coming on. I mean, I appreciate more than anything just how quickly you got back to me. Honestly, I literally the day I got it in the mail, I was just on my way out the door to the gym, and I was like, oh man, I shouldn't go to the gym. I really want to watch this. And I was like, no, go to the gym. So I went to the gym. I worked out probably the fastest I've worked out in years. Like, ran home, made myself some lunch, just laid out on the couch. I'm like, this is going to be an experience. And it was. It blew my mind. It was, I mean, I had expectations, maybe unfairly so to you, but luckily, I mean, you surpassed all of them. And again, like I said, I didn't know exactly what I was getting into. I didn't know exactly what it was about. And I sat down. When it ended, I was like, damn, it's over? Like, I watched through all the extras, everything that was on there. And then immediately I just ran to my computer. I'm like, you know what? The hell, I'm going to see if I can get him on our show. And I wrote you, and less than 24 hours later, you responded. And I can't thank you enough.
What you have to understand is I love talking about Star Wars toys. Movie or not, forget the movie. This was, you know, I love talking about Star Wars toys. So some guy's like, hey, want to talk about Star Wars toys? Yeah, okay. Golden. Score.
Absolutely.
What? Done. Yeah, so, I appreciate your reaching out to me, and I'm glad that people are enjoying the film. You know, it's something that I did with a couple friends. We did it, you know, for the community. You know, it's documentaries are labors of love. I did it because I love Star Wars toys, and I wanted to give something to this community that is part of what I love about collecting Star Wars toys, all the people involved. So if people dig it, then, you know, I'm thrilled. You know, I'm glad I hope I did the hobby proud, and yeah, so...
I would have to say that you definitely did. You know, and... Before we end the episode here, I just wanted to remind all our listeners that we will be doing, we'll be talking about our next matchup on the next episode. If you haven't written into us yet about that, feel free to. You know, the matchup is who would win in a brawl between Wurr and Dexter Jetster. If you want to weigh in on that, you can obviously write to us on Facebook, facebook.com/WampusLairPodcast. You can tweet us on Twitter, twitter.com/WampusLair. And you can always email us at wampuslairpodcast@gmail.com. And obviously find us and all the other great Star Wars podcasts over at starwarsreport.com. Brian, again, thank you times 1,000. Just you are a wealth of information. It's very clear that, I mean, when I watched that film, I honestly didn't know what to expect. And I literally felt like I just watched something on like A&E or the History Channel. Like it's that good. I mean, it's... From a technical standpoint, I mean, it's so professionally well done. It's funny, too. Like, some of the stuff you do with the people you interview with, it's really clever. Like, I chuckled, I was informed, and I lost myself in it. I mean, it was the perfect Star Wars homage to the toys. And it I cannot say enough about it. And seriously, if you are listening to this right now and you haven't ordered a copy by the end of this episode, seriously, you're doing yourself a disservice. It's a fantastic film.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the kind words. And again, thank you for having me on. It was a lot of fun.
My pleasure. My pleasure. So everyone, I hope you enjoyed this amazing episode, episode 75, Plastic Galaxy, an interview with Brian Stillman. So, until next time, we will see you later, and see you in the Wampa's Lair.